That music feels way too cool for me. Good morning, everyone. My name is Evie Martin. I'm the lead pastor here at Plattwoods Church. Good to see all of you the week after Easter, especially those of you who maybe came for the first time on Easter and now are back. Thanks for coming back. It's good to have you here. Good to have you joining us on the live stream as well this morning. I grew up in the church. I come from a long line of devoted Christians on both sides of my family. There are several pastors peppered into the genealogy as well. Faith and religion is a world in which I'm pretty comfortable. It's the language I speak, so to speak. When I was a kid, I attended a small Free Methodist church, evangelical in nature. My uncle was the pastor of it for a while. My mom played piano. My dad taught my middle school Sunday school class, which was often just me and my best friend, whose dad also sometimes taught us. We didn't have fancy curriculum or videos or study guides, really. We would just show up on Sunday mornings and read the Bible and ask questions about it. In hindsight, I realized that was perhaps a less common Sunday school experience for teens in the Bible Belt in the 90s than I thought. But I remember fondly our early study of Genesis chapter 1. My dad had us read it out loud, and then he asked us, how many days did it take God to create the world? And we said 6, obviously. And then my dad, with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, said, then what about the dinosaurs? That question, and many others like it in my teenage years, was an important landmark in my faith development. It was a moment in which my adolescent brain had to acknowledge that something in the words of this story that I loved dearly, and something in the archaeology of the world that I also enjoyed immensely, didn't seem to line up. And I was lucky enough to have a family and a faith community where exploring the possible disparity was a welcome adventure, not a forbidden enterprise. That was the first time I remember consciously opening the door to faith and science. This month, we are diving into what I hope is an interesting series for you. We'll be exploring topics that, at least in recent history, and often longer than that, have been viewed as either in conflict or completely incompatible with a Christian faith. My hope is that we'll develop some theological muscles to not have to choose one over the other, but to hold them together in ways that are thoughtful, meaningful, and can even have an impact on our lives and the lives of others. I will confess, these are not easy sermons. Just writing this one made me think that we could do 4 weeks just on faith and science. So our brains might hurt a little today. Just hold on. It's going to be fine. But I do hope to give you a few handholds for this topic, and you can check your e-note each week to explore some of the other resources that we use in preparing to preach about these topics. If you got our e-note last week, I already shared 4 resources that I use to prepare this sermon. But as we begin each week, I'd like to take a moment to address the or that's crossed out in the logo. Where did the idea of faith or, fill in the blank, even come from? What is the problem that we're trying to address? How did we get to this proposed binary choice of faith or science to begin with? There's really no seminal moment in time to point to that answers that question, but we can certainly look back over history and see ebbs and flows of the relationship between religion and science, particularly institutionalized religion. We think notably of figures like Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and even Newton a little bit later on, who were all religious men, asking huge questions of the universe and advancing human understanding of how exactly we exist therein, positing a heliocentric solar system, elliptical planetary orbits, laws of motion, science that today we'd be delusional to deny. And yet, in their hypotheses and discoveries, each one of them found themselves sometimes supported by, but more often at odds with, the church to varying degrees. Fast forward to the 19th century, most notably the work of Charles Darwin in evolutionary science. Darwin's science just so happened to be emerging at the same time as a new approach to biblical interpretation was on the rise, an approach we now call biblical literalism. So you put this new science and a literal approach to scripture together at the same time, and you get a perfect setup for an absolute clash of realities, or at least a clash of two modes of understanding the world and our place in it. Both religion and science at that time suddenly put deep stakes into the ground for having the only way to explain or understand the world and human experience. And when you set up a binary like that, conflict is the only option. That conflict may have seen its apex in the late 19th and on into the 20th centuries, but the residual effect is still with us today. That wasn't that long ago. You must choose faith or science. You can't have both. We know the conflict is still with us to a degree because we have places like the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, where millions of dollars have been invested to explain just exactly how the Earth is only 6,000 years old, dinosaurs, carbon dating, and all. And then on the other side, we have scientists like Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, who says that faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. But those kinds of examples seem more like the far edges of the bell curve to me. I think the vast majority of thinking people of faith, as well as the majority of thoughtful scientists, fall along a much wider spectrum, probably somewhere in that bell in the middle. I think the human mind and heart have the capacity for much more than this binary proposition. Humans are built for and. Physicist and theologian Ian Barber is the modern scholar who has given us the most helpful framework for and to date. In a series of lectures he did right in the early 90s, which later became several different books on religion and science, Barber identifies four ways we can think about the relationship between faith and science. His work remains the standard for these discussions even today. And the working question that he set out to answer was, when science meets religion, enemies, strangers, or partners? So the four possibilities that he names for this relationship between faith and science are conflict, independence, dialogue, or integration. In talking about conflict, the claim is that science and religion make rival statements about the same domain, so a person must choose between them. This is the category that we've already sort of been talking about, where our or comes from, the Creation Museum or the scientists who insist there can be no divine actor in the world. In the independence model, science and religion are distinct from one another because they're asking and answering different questions. Science is asking what and how, religion is asking who and why. So they're exploring different realms. They employ different methods, science tests, religion experiences. And so they can both exist, but they need to stay in their own corners, so to speak. With the dialogue model, Barber suggests that no, actually there are constructive relationships between religion and science. So this model highlights the similarities rather than the differences in what each one is trying to accomplish. We're all trying to understand more of what got us here and what it means that we're here. And then finally, with integration, it goes one step further. There's not just dialogue or conversation between the two, but there's actually overlap between science and religion with regard to our sources for knowledge. The examination of the natural world can actually lead us closer to the divine revelation, and the pursuit of divine gives meaning to our scientific discoveries. So both science and religion contribute to an inclusive metaphysics. So as you think about those four categories, conflict, independence, dialogue, and integration, you can read a lot about these online. You just Google Ian Barber and you can find all the things. You might find one that feels kind of like where you are. And really, with the exception of conflict, all of these have room for the and. These frameworks give us lots of room in our lives and in our minds as Christians and as scientists for faith and science. So even still, with the latitude that some of those categories offer, for people who follow a Christian faith, there's sometimes still a sticking point when it comes to working out these two approaches to truth and knowing. So we need to take a moment here to talk about the Bible. When it comes to friction between faith and science, whether it's real or perceived, often the cause is rooted in this text or a tightly held interpretation of this text that we hold sacred. When the Bible says that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, but science shows us evolution on a millions of year scale, what are we supposed to do with that? When Exodus describes Moses parting the waters of the Red Sea, how can we empirically explain such a thing? When Jesus walks on water or heals a blind man by rubbing mud and saliva on his eyes, what scientific method can produce the same results? The Bible is the sacred narrative with which we seek to align our lives. This book matters to us deeply. It reveals God's truth to us. It shapes the way we live and love and die. It is a source of revelation for our faith. So when another narrative of reality comes up alongside it or against it, we might feel threatened. We might reject new information. We might abandon what we once believed to be true, or we might come back to our text with new eyes, curious how our understanding might evolve or grow. How we read and understand the Bible is a massive topic that deserves a lot of time and attention. And fortunately for you, Pastor Chung Ho is teaching a class designed to do just that. How to Read the Bible is happening every Wednesday night in April at 6:30. You can use that QR code that you did to check in to register for that. Please do. There's childcare available. But every Wednesday night this month, you can attend that class. I promise you want to rearrange your schedule to go to that class. We can unpack a lot more than I can do right here. But thank you, Pastor Chung Ho, for teaching. It's an awesome class. But I want to take just a moment to look at an example of why the Bible and the narrative it weaves is not inherently in conflict with the worldview that science offers to us. So we'll look briefly at Genesis chapter 1. It's where I started the sermon as well. This is the primary text that has been at the root of Barber's conflict model. Because the origin story, our origin story in the Judeo-Christian tradition, simply doesn't jive with the origin narrative of science. How is it that we as 21st century American readers should be thinking as we open to the very first pages of our Bible? Well, in a few moments today, we're going to commission a team of people from Platt Woods who are leaving on a service and learning trip to Guatemala this Saturday. When we land in Guatemala, we do not assume that everyone there will speak English to us, that they will transport us to our hotel in an American-made SUV, swing by a Starbucks on the way, and be up to speed on everything Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. If that is how we showed up in Guatemala, we would be very bad travelers. No, we assume and we prepare for stepping into a cross-cultural context where we have learned at least some basic words of Spanish, where we will pay close attention to the things around us, dress according to their custom, and ask lots of questions to try and understand who our hosts are and how they communicate with us. May I offer that opening our Bible is exactly the same kind of experience. We are stepping across cultures and time, for that matter. So let's think about this with that framework in mind, just with the first few verses of Genesis chapter 1. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'het haaretz. Got it? Tracking? Great. Because everyone here understands biblical Hebrew. No, right off the bat, we have cross-cultural work to do. We've translated this familiar phrase across the globe over 3 millennia, so now we better recognize it and understand it as, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In a different translation, we hear, when God began to create the heavens and the earth. Okay, so let's be good cross-cultural travelers here and try to think about the world that our storytellers inhabit. The word eretz, translated as you heard as earth, what image does the word earth conjure up in your mind? Probably something like this. Yeah? We envision the planet, this little blue dot in its entirety, round, rotating, home to 8 billion humans. Let me ask this, when was the first picture like that taken? 1947. That's the year my dad was born. The first picture of the Earth from outer space, 65 miles above the surface of the Earth. We didn't get that whole globe image until the late 60s. So that's three generations of people in human history who have an actual visual scientific frame of reference for Earth, Eretz, as the blue planet. What did the Hebrew people 3,000 years ago think of when they heard the word Eretz? Not that. They thought of this. The ground beneath their feet. The dirt, the land, as far as the eye could see, sure, but there was not yet any concept of planet for them. The first verse of the origin story of Genesis is not trying to tell us an astrophysical tale. Does that mean it is in conflict with modern planetary science and must be discarded? No. It means the storyteller has their own purpose in their own place and time. Or let's take it on to verse 6. What are we to make of this? And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. What is this dome they are talking about? Did you learn about a dome in science? In Hebrew, it's a tricky word. The word is rakia. In English, that gets translated a lot of different ways. In King James, we read firmament, whatever a firmament is. We see the word dome in the NRSV. In the NIV, it reads vault. What is this thing that separates the waters from the waters? There's not water up there. We know there's atmosphere and then there's space. But what do our storytellers see in their world? They see the Eretz beneath their feet, and they know there is water below the Eretz, because what happens when you dig deep enough? And when you look up, what is there? A big blue canopy? And sometimes water comes in from there too. So there must be something keeping it from falling all the time. What is it? It's the rakia, the dome, the vault, put in between to keep the waters from just crashing in all the time and destroying everything. The literal definition of the word rakia is an extended surface, a solid expanse, as if beaten or hammered out. So maybe you can imagine a little bit more how they saw their world. God fashioning our home, clearing out space between the water down here and the water up here by hammering out, by flattening in place a rakia, so we would have a safe place to live. Is this the language of a geologist or an attempt to persuade a reader of the physics and mechanics of atmospheric science? It's not. Is it then incompatible with any subsequent knowledge that does explain the water cycle and the cocktail of gases that hold our oxygen in and keep us all from imploding or suffocating? No, it's not incompatible. It is simply not telling us a science story. It's telling the story for an entirely different reason. It's telling the story to say something about God and the kind of God that's revealed to us in creation. With our cross-cultural lenses on, we can notice that it's telling a story of a creator God who is very different than the other creator gods of nearby people groups. The origin stories at the time of the Babylonians and the Canaanites tell of a created world that is born out of conflict between gods, one god tearing apart another god and using the parts of her body to form the parts of the earth. Humanity and the world we inhabit is the product of violence and conflict. It isn't good. The Genesis story, by contrast, shows us a God who is one, a God who makes with words, not with weapons, a God who needs no violence to bring order out of chaos, but merely speaks and then says, "This is good." And this is all just the first chapter. When we're able to tune into the Bible cross-culturally, to listen for what it intends rather than what we want to know, it gives us plenty of room for faith and. If Genesis isn't worried about a 6-24-hour-a-day schedule and disapproval of the Big Bang, we shouldn't be either. We can hold fast to what this story tells us about God and God's relationship with humanity, and we don't have to throw out the dinosaurs. We have to be careful. We're not trying to ask questions of the Bible that it isn't trying to answer. For Christians, the Bible is a primary source of God's revelation of God's self and God's nature to us. But it's not the only source. There are other ways that God is revealed to us as well, and the Bible even names that. Psalm 19, among other verses, claims, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament," there's that word again, "proclaims God's handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech. There are no words. Their voice is not heard, and yet their voice goes out through all the earth." All the created world, the book of nature, as many theologians have called it, the same subject that feeds the souls and drives the work of scientists across the ages, is revealing something to us of God. No words are necessary. Why wouldn't the work in the realm of science be gift and treasure to those of us with faith? Discovery is revelation. It draws us closer to the wonder and the working of the one who made us. At the heart of both faith and science is a value that is near and dear to us at Plattwoods Church: curiosity. Curiosity is what draws us into all the questions: what, how, who, why. And curiosity at its best leads to more questions and deeper understanding, but it never arrives at an end. It always leaves room for new revelation, insight, discovery, growth, both in our experience of faith and in our study of science. Both disciplines can get into trouble, however, when the value of certainty becomes the highest priority. And both religion and science do this, by the way. They, at times, do not admit their limits. Certainty can be a source of comfort. Certainty can be used to influence and control others. Certainty is easier to live with, even if it's not a full picture of what is real or true. Empirical evidence, data, and testing, the methods of science, provide certainty about many things that religion does not. But even science cannot claim that it can provide certainty in all matters. No good scientist would make such a claim, although some have. Even science has its limits. Religion, on the other hand, that claims certainty in its explanation of the how and the what questions, leaves no room for new understanding or human discovery. And so when certainty in faith fails to budge and adapt, it makes itself obsolete. It turns into a museum, trying desperately to convince intelligent modern humans that the earth is 6,000 years old. A friend of mine captured it just right, I think, as he reflected on his experience of faith and science. He grew up going to religious school, and he said, "The more I went to religion class, the less I believed in God. The more I went to science class, the more I believed in God. I mean, just look at how the eye is made." For him, one class dealt in certainty, with no room for the questions that he naturally had as a teenager. The other allowed space for curiosity and wonder, and that alone revealed something of the magnificence of our Creator. When we lean into faith and science from Barber's perspective of either dialogue or integration, one of those last two, we come to see that each discipline has much to offer the other, and curiosity is the key. When we as the people of faith are curious about science, science can actually lead us deeper into our faith. It might help us read our story in a different and more profound way. Astrophysics blows our minds with the beauty and expanse of divine creativity at our origins. Physiology makes us marvel at the very sinew and bones we inhabit in the image of the one who made us. Quantum physics and all of its exploration of where and how particles exist and behave across time and space and also simultaneously might give us a new framework for imagining what happens to us after we die. Jesus' resurrection is still mysterious to us. Maybe science has more to reveal to us about our own recreation. With curiosity, as people of faith, we can always be asking of science, What does this reveal to us about God? And science, when it is practicing curiosity in conversation with faith can always be asking, what does this mean about us? Thanks to science, we can clone, we can heal people, we can genetically modify plants, we can predict solar eclipses, we can harvest stem cells. Thanks to science, we may have humans on Mars within decades. Thanks to science, humans are the only species that have figured out how to annihilate themselves. Anyone see Oppenheimer? Thanks to science, humans also have the technology and capability to save the planet. Science can do many things and will continue to pursue the impossible until it is possible. But just because we can do something doesn't mean we always should. And sometimes what we should do, we don't. Religion, as the discipline dedicated to making meaning out of the human condition, can be a good conversation partner to help science answer that question. What does this mean about us? And now that we can do this thing, what should we do? Faith and science are not mutually exclusive. What time and progress have shown us is that they are rather mutually beneficial when we approach each one with humility and curiosity. There is no or, there is only and. John Polkinghorne, renowned theoretical physicist and Anglican priest, paved the way for a modern integration of faith and science. If you want to dive deeper into this topic, just look him up. You can watch or read any of his lectures or books. He changed the conversation on these topics for the whole world and for generations to come. And I'll end with his words, since he's sort of the expert on the matter. I want to take science and religion with great and equal seriousness. I see them as complementary to each other, not as rivals. The most important thing that they have in common is that both believe there is a truth to be sought and found, a truth whose attainment comes through the pursuit of well-motivated belief. I can be two-eyed. I can look with the eye of science, and I can look with the eye of religion. And I'll see more with that binocular vision than I will with either eye on its own. Will you pray with me? Giver of life, mover of planets, architect of atoms. What miracles you have made for us to explore every day. Through the eye of science, may we marvel at the design, the cause and effect, the deeper questions that open before us. Through the eye of faith, may we point to mystery and say, who are we that we can know such things? And how can we be wise with such knowledge? May our faith and eyes reveal to us who you are and who we are made to be. In the name of Christ, beginning and always, amen.